Name, Jason Horsley. Profession, Limitless. This is The Limitless, the podcast in between. You are now listening. You can walk an island way and you work all the rolling dust. Your eyes were staring at me while playing your guitar.
I came walking a long way just for another chap. Then I saw her in the crowd and I looked her in the eyes.
So, I thought we'd just start with the body, where everything begins. I just got back from yoga. I just do it. I don't do it as a big discipline. Well, it's actually is probably the main discipline in my life, just to get there. Well, I was interested in what you said on that podcast where I reached out about how you've been practicing yoga and how one of the results, perhaps the primary result, is releasing trauma in the body, which is probably my main focus, really, is that. I mean, allowing that to happen one way or another. And I have not heard about yoga talked about in that context, even though that's my experience in a very subtle way, which I can get into in a bit, maybe. But so let's just start there. Like, is that your own interpretation? Is that your own discovery? Is there backup research on that? What have you got?
With regards to yoga and trauma specifically?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it kind of came about, that understanding came about after about maybe 2-3 years practicing. And my sort of yoga thing start, you know, asana, specifically because the word yoga has kind of got a very broad spectrum of methodologies and systems, but largely it's asana, you know, the practice of kind of asana. And it wasn't till I really started getting into the sort of what's kind of described as a bit of a hardcore end of yoga, the practice of Ashtanga, that I kind of really started to find out more. You know, when I first started yoga, Jason, it was the first time I did a yoga class, I woke up in the morning the day after and couldn't believe how good I felt, having, you know, done a bit of working out in the gym and all this kind of stuff. And it's probably about 20 odd years ago, I did my first ever yoga class, and I woke up in the morning the day after and I felt as good as I've ever felt in my life upon waking up. So that to me was a signal. It was like, okay, I want to explore this. I want to know more about this feeling. I want to kind of reach into this more, learn more, experience more. And for the first sort of 2, 3, 4 years, something like that, I went to this is called Iyengar yoga.
So, yeah, you know, same kind of idea. Yeah.
And so Iyengar is kind of, you do the sort of, you know, half a dozen standing poses, half a dozen sitting poses, you know, this kind of thing. And it's very, very precise. My teacher actually said, the guy's name was BKS Iyengar. And my teacher said that stood for bang, kick and slap. Because apparently when he taught, he'd kind of, you know, slap you on the leg to kind of straighten you up and kick your foot, you know, he's kind of one of these sort of hardcore yogi types. And but it, after sort of 2-3 years, I found it was a great discipline, because it ended up sort of where each toe was, the exact angle that your arm was at, where the, you know, the angle your wrist was rotated at. It was extremely precise and quite subtle. I've very often in my life I've set aside 10 years to learn or study or practice something. If I like my first impression of something, and then the following two or three things I do, I enjoy as well. It's, and I get the feeling, it's like, okay, I want to know how good this can get. So I kind of quite happy to spend 10 years on a single thing, as well as getting on with the rest of my stuff.
Right.
And so I started doing the Mysore class, and then I heard about I heard this conversation that yoga releases trauma, and I kind of didn't really believe it. I didn't sort of, it was like, okay, I haven't got much trauma and this, that, and the other, you know, ostensibly. And then I remember one, I can't remember the which asana it was, I was doing something and I felt something move. I felt something release in the top of my thigh towards my buttock or something. I can't remember exactly. And I felt something release, and I knew at the time it related to when I was kind of beaten. It sounds a bit, well, kind of punished or whatever the word is, by my dad when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And I could remember kind of knotting up my muscles, you know, if I got hit, you know, quite sort of disciplined, sort of old school sort of stuff. And as soon as I realized that there was this kind of subtle held trauma that related to a tension or a knotting of kind of like trying to defend an area of one's body, but so subtle, and this was kind of probably going back 40 years ago, so I kind of found this kind of trauma in that. And that was like okay, so there's validity to my mind at that point. I realized there's validity to that statement. So that is how I experienced a release of trauma, whether that's the right word or not, I don't know, with it held in a deep musculature or physiology that was released probably through stretching and releasing, stretch releasing, but I wasn't even aware that the trauma was there until it went. And it wasn't a pop or a bang, it was just sort of like, oh, okay. And instantly I'm this subtle connection of that's what that was. I wasn't looking for it, thinking about it. I'm not troubled by the fact my dad was a bit of a whatever. He wasn't that bad, I suppose, but it, you know, I wasn't even aware that that was something going on, you know. So in that way, that led me to the understanding that trauma was there, you know.
So is there literature on this that you know of now, trauma and yoga to this?
Not I'm aware of.
Okay, that's interesting then, because I thought maybe it just passed me by. And as I say, you know, I've been doing yoga this time around. I used to do it alone for years with a tape. I don't know how much that counts, but anyway, this time around for the last 3 or 4 years or something, and simply motivated by sciatica. I was going to do martial arts, and I realized that sciatica was my sciatica would, you know, would be, it wouldn't be helped by something so exerting as martial arts. So I settled for yoga, and I just do it twice a week. And the source of the sciatica is unknown, but I understand it as energetic. I did from day one, really. Whatever that means, I mean something that's trapped in the body, let's say, something in the past. And it also relates to the curvature of my spine. Like I think there's a technical term for it, but my spine is slightly curved in the middle there, at the back, and that has a ripple down effect, I guess, in all kinds of ways in terms of lack of flexibility. So, I mean, one of the first things I noticed, of course, as everyone does when I went to yoga, was how inflexible I am doing positions, asanas, that I simply wouldn't normally try, right? And just on a day-to-day basis, one doesn't touch one's toes. There's no need to touch one's toes, just to use the most obvious example. So, and then the emotional experience around that, of experiencing my lack of flexibility, the frustration, despair, irritation, all the rest of it. And some positions are more intense than others. There's certainly positions where I actually feel like I'm being crucified. I mean, I imagine this is what Christ must have felt like, just in the sense of having to stay in a position that is so uncomfortable, and imagining, as I do, you know, if I had to stay in this position indefinitely. And it's not just the physical discomfort, it's the mental anxiety of it. And so the more I had these experiences, the more I began to consider that, you know, what's going on when I go to yoga, because I never want to go. I kind of 50% enjoy, 50% don't enjoy it, but afterwards I always feel a lot better. Mm. And hence I keep going, knowing that. And one of the primary ways I feel better, I'd say, is I feel lighter. It's like I feel physically lighter, although I'm very skinny, so this isn't a literal thing. It's not like I need to lose weight. But more, another way of putting it is more spacious in the body. There's more space in the body, which
more
is...
space in the body, yeah.
Perhaps metaphorical, perhaps literal. And so then, combining all those things, I did deduce, in a much less categorical way than yourself, I haven't had a single experience where it's like, aha, it's happening, but just a general sense of, okay, so this is, and because my primary focus for the last 9 years, I just turned 49 today actually, so that's 9 years, pretty much since I turned 40, has been more and more on the trauma in my past, the traumatic experiences in my past, and how they have got trapped in the body, and how that's prevented me from being embodied, from actually being in my body. Okay. As a psyche, as an awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to make good sense logically as well, in terms of, because the asanas take us, our attention, into areas where the body isn't flexible, where there's resistance, where there's pain, logically is where, you know, something has got trapped in the body, something has gone wrong, quote unquote, with the body.
Mm-hmm.
And so just putting one's attention on those areas is putting one's attention on the trauma.
Yes.
You know, not on the past and what happened, because mm-hmm. that's buried, and most of the time, maybe it wasn't in your case with that one example, but a lot of the time I think it's buried in terms of memory. But it's body memory, you know. This is, I think, what trauma relates to, is that...
Yeah.
What we can't process mentally or emotionally just goes straight into the body.
Mm. Okay. So you mentioned space in the body? Space in the body.
Yeah, more space in the body.
Space in the body. So, you know, this particularly interests me from all you know, several angles. So, okay, so... You know, space in the body. So, a few last August or late last summer. So, you know, I practiced the yoga, and I sort of last summer we were practicing. My partner and I, who is a yoga teacher, she'll be back probably in a while. She might even join the conversation. I don't know. And we're practicing in, we live in a hut in the forest, but there's a meadow alongside us. And so on a sunny evening, late, you know, early sunny evening, sun's going down, it's like, let's go and practice in the meadow. You know, it's beautiful, you know, nice grass and what have you. So we did a series, you know, both kind of working through, and at the end you do the asana called Shavasana.
Mm-hmm.
Shavasana, corpse pose. And it was kind of quite revelatory to me, because you know, I'm practicing Buddhist, it's kind of my main sort of thing that I'm into, and I've contemplated and meditated upon death hundreds, if not thousands, of times, and the death is the most is the most active conversation in my mind. So, you know, when I sort of chatter to myself, my thought processes are the most ongoing, continual conversation is my own death. I'm kind of like, I'm always engaging with, is it today, is it now? You know, I'm always thinking about that and kind of that process. I'm kind of sort of not in a morbid way. It's kind of, it's more like sort of, it's going to come, and when it comes, I'll kind of want to, okay, I've kind of thought about this. And from a Buddhist tantric perspective, I've prepared for the manifestations, illusions within the mind as the body dies. So
is this a conscious discipline on your part, or would you just say it's a natural tendency? Because I have the same thing.
I think
second what you just said.
I think it's a learned behavior. So I've you know, and death is on my mind as a result of being aware that it is an important subject to focus one's mind on. Do I believe that or not? Well, all these great people seem to have said it's kind of worth spending a bit of time on it. So anyway, so that's the reason why. So after the Shavasana, or during the Shavasana, I was laying down in the meadow, beautiful evening, and I actually had a feeling that I was dying. And the first I had this sort of millisecond of panic, and it's like, is this the spot, is this the part of the place on earth where it all ends, where my story ends? And I kind of lay there, and after it was only a millisecond of fear, and it was like, okay, well, if this is the case, you've got to let go. So as a result of this kind of like letting go at that point, I felt I imagined or felt, I don't know, it's kind of a close correlation between the two, I felt my body disintegrate into the ground. And I felt as if sort of mushrooms were growing out of the ground through me, and a tree grew through me, and I was just kind of, my physical body was just kind of disintegrated, and the world disappeared. And it was kind of a little tinsy bit scary at the beginning, but then after after a moment or two, it was like, okay, it's you want to know what it's like, this is what it's like, just do it. And it was kind of, it was beautiful and quite profound. Then talking about space in the body. So this is a kind of a preamble to a couple more things. So I've been following, as I'm sure you're aware in your own world, the story of CERN, the Hadron Collider. You know, I'm kind of fascinated by this kind of journeying back to the beginning of the universe and smashing things together to find out what they are and what they're comprised of. And the sort of current story is this apocryphal 94% of unknowable stuff, the dark matter, or the
was it down to 94%? I remember it being 98%.
So there's this whole sort of concept that what we know and see and measure and relate to is six or two or whatever, you know. It's
a small fragment.
Yes, 6%, and 94% is unknowable from our perceptive tunnel. And I kind of then, you know, I'm kind of interested in this kind of story, and you know, I'm sort of fascinated to know where it goes, even though I think I know. But the day or two late, we're doing yoga again in the meadow, Shavasana, and I had this like, oh, you're dying again, and it was profound, and you know, it was, you know, sunset, it was kind of quite cinematic, and at this time I thought, okay, so you're dying, you've got to let go, just do it, man, let it go. And at that point I thought, okay, but what I am actually letting go of is 6% of all that is me, because the 6% is all that is knowable of me. The mind that we have at present, or the mind I have at present, is only capable or aware of the 6%. So as a result of that, I kind of had this kind of vision of that I am, all I know of myself is 6%, whereas 94% is dark matter or dark energy or unknowable stuff. And at this point, I had this kind of feeling, oh, I want to do a drawing to represent that. And that drawing turned into that series of 12 that I sent you, that I called The Sacred Geometry of Yoga, which was a means of describing the experience, sort of trying to represent the experiences through a, you know, geometric art form. So this was me trying to find, so, you know, geometry, you know, measure, line, this kind of, you know, structure is more about there's the nodes where things connect, but there's a lot of space in geometry. Geometry necessarily, there's space in, you know, a triangle, a cube, a, you know, sphere, whatever, you know. So my interest is shifted from the nodes, the physicality, to the space between the physicality, this kind of 94%. But the sort of the way I understand understanding of scriptural descriptions and understanding is that all is empty of inherent existence. This is described as emptiness of inherent existence. And so this representation I had with regard to death, of recognizing that actually there's only 6% of what I hold to be. So why aren't I more interested in the 94% that doesn't hurt, is fine, is doing its own thing? Why, you know, and I've got this thing in my body and I want to do this and in and in and in, you know, this happens, that happens in my body, and I want food, I want this, I want it. And it's like, why I'm preoccupied with the tiniest, or, you know, a very small fraction of what I am. So why am I focusing my attention on that is so this is part of the journey as well, is to realize, or for me to realize, this the 100%, the everything is, you know, as, you know, again, scripture described, is the nature of a dream, and this is my entire process, is engaged now in this potential to wake up from the dream. Wake up from the dream. Yeah.
At all familiar with psychology of trauma?
No.
I'm going to give it a shot anyway to try and describe it. I've been writing about it for several years now, but I'm still having a difficult time putting it into words, I think, because it relates to this, the 6%, the 94%, as I see it. That's one of the reasons it's difficult to talk about, because we're trying to talk about the 94% using the 6%, and it doesn't fit. But this is also true of trauma. What they say about trauma is it's too great, something too great for the psyche to process, or for the body perhaps to process and assimilate. And so it gets, well, fragmentation occurs, and the psyche develops a defense against trauma, a defense against the trauma that's happened that it can't process, and a defense against any.
Excuse me. I'm just so I can be clear on what you're saying here. So the psyche has a defense against physical trauma or psychological, if such a thing exists, I don't quite know, psychological trauma.
Well, it's a very good question, and so I said to begin with, it's difficult to languify, because I think because when the psyche is fragmented through trauma, if it is, this happens in a real sense, we end up with the f
Hang on,
with
so I'm just going to backtrack again because I really want to understand what you're saying. So, what do you mean by I've known the word, of course, fragmented by trauma? The psyche is fragmented. So the instant image I get is like an egg that's kind of cracked and bits and bits, but I what do you mean the psyche fragmented?
Well, what does the psyche mean to you? Let's start with that.
I don't have an interpretation or definition of the word psyche, and I'm kind of a little bit, well, if you tell me what your definition is, then I'll be able to relate from your perspective, because I don't hold a definition of the word psyche. It's a very, it's an easy throwaway phrase. We're trying to sort of dive into the 94%. It's important for me to try and understand your reference points, then I can meet you, kind of thing, you know?
Absolutely. So that unknown, you used the word unknowable. I would say it's unknown, but not unknowable. The unknown 90 whatever percent. You could say that we experience that on a daily basis as what's been called the unconscious. So there are things, there's an aspect of our experience and of our existence that is unconscious, that we're unconscious of. So even if we just refer to dreams, the most obvious place, we wake up every morning and we know that something's happened, that we've had these experiences, but we can only retrieve a very small amount of it. We all have that experience, right? So then the idea of the unconscious then relates to the psyche, that there's a whole aspect of us, our being, our totality, that is unknown to us, that seems to be inaccessible to us. So the psyche, in a way, is like one of those words, and it means soul. It's Greek for soul, but then of course soul is no better. It's one of, as a word, it's one of those words that we, it's like a seat keeper or a place setter, whatever you call those things, where you mark this spot to say there's something here that we don't know what it is, right?
Okay, just so what I'll do is I'll run past my understanding of what you describe as psyche. So in my understanding, my studies, whatever, it relates to degrees of subtlety of mind.
Of consciousness, then, let's say, because
Mind consciousness, again, if that's a very interesting sort of area. Consciousness, mind, are they the same thing? Whoa, it is very, very, we're kind of walking on gray areas, but
Well, I don't know. I think it's a very important distinction, because we don't make a dichotomy between body and consciousness.
Distinction between what? Sorry, I'm sorry, Jason.
We don't make a distinction between body and consciousness. We recognize that consciousness and body are, coexistent and synonymous to a certain extent. Whereas mind and body, we've got this idea, and I think there's a reason for it, which relates to what we're kind of feeling our way around now, which is this fragment. To me, the fragment that the psyche, that
Sorry, Jason. So mind
is a fragment, as I'm in this model I'm trying to describe. Mind is definitely a fragment.
Mind is a fragment of
psyche.
Mind is a fragment of psyche.
Yeah.
Okay. That's kind of okay. And how would, may I ask you, your definition of mind?
This is what I was trying to get to, and so my definition of mind relates to, and I was going to mention Reich's body armor earlier. I don't know if you're familiar with Reich and that whole thing.
No.
Okay, so that probably wouldn't help anyway, but it's definitely relevant to yoga and the body and how trauma gets trapped in the body, because Reich's idea was that because of that, you know, we have this kind of body armor, which is like an identity that actually prevents us from living in our body and moving our body in natural ways and whatnot. So that is similar to the psychological model of trauma, which relates to a traumatic a self-care system that comes up in the psyche due to intense trauma to protect the individual, whether it's bodily or psychologically or both, that is a fuzzy area, from further traumas. And that self-care system essentially it prevents us from becoming aware of the whole psyche. And so it creates the mind, as I see it, is a as like a constructed identity that comes about through trauma when a portion of the psyche is put forward as a defense against future trauma, and that can only exist through amnesia. So it's like a part of ourselves that splits off from the whole psyche due to trauma to prevent future trauma, and then forgets that it's done so. And the fragments of the psyche, this is very, very difficult to put into words, but the fragments, or the cracks in the psyche, if you will, relate to amnesia barriers. So when there's very intense trauma, a barrier comes up in the psyche to protect itself from future trauma, and but also to forget the trauma that's happened, because it can't be processed. It's just too much. It's too overwhelming. So, one of the areas that I'm very unclear about here is the relationship between the psyche and the body. Like when we're infants, because this relates to when we're infants, that before we have minds in the sense that you and I think of minds, right? We don't have language. And so what has been observed about infants, although very few of us can remember this experience, is that that as infants we don't have
as very small children
we don't have an identity as yet. We're physically present, but we don't have language, we don't have a self-reflective identity, we're not thinking, we're just or even feeling emotionally, we're just receiving experience directly into the body. And what in psychology this is called affect. So before we've developed these filters of mentality and emotionality and thought and identity, experience just goes direct into the body. And where is the psyche in the meantime in this period? My sense is that the psyche doesn't fully land in the body until after we're born, particularly if there's difficulty in birth. And I mean, it's very hard to have a comparison point, because we live in a world in which trauma, I mean excessive trauma beyond just the necessary trauma or inevitable trauma of birth, has become so prevalent that we don't have anything to compare it to. But my sense is that that the psyche is supposed to land in the body at some point during birth or after birth in those first couple of years, but that when there's intense trauma, this becomes impossible due to this fragmentation of the psyche. Now, what is the fragmentation of the psyche? You're right, I don't know. Like, nobody really knows what does that mean. But it does seem to relate to what happens to the body when the body experiences intense trauma that it can't process because it's too much. Like, the body has limits. And so that trauma gets trapped in the body because it's not getting processed, and then that the trapped trauma prevents the psyche from landing in the body. So there seems to be a correlation between the body's blockage and the fragmentation of the trauma, whether the fragmentation of the psyche, beg your pardon, whether they're actually synonymous or not, because we have this mystery, like, what is the psyche? Is it physically present? Is it physically real? Or is it a metaphor? And anyway.
Okay, so I want to sort of shift track a little bit here, and mm-hmm. and I kind of want to ask you the nature of the trauma through which you are wishing to release or process. You know, if this is too, if you don't want to talk about this, I kind of understand, but at the same time, we can talk on an intellectual ping pong level for as long as you want, you know, which is fine.
Mm-hmm.
But if you know, are you comfortable in describing the trauma? Because there could be a process or analysis or a method or a yoga that pertains to your particular trauma, Jason. And I'm not trying to therapize or kind of sort things out, but to me, that's kind of like, okay, we can sort of chit chat.
Sure, yeah, I want rubber to meet road. I agree. However, because the nature of the trauma, or what I'm describing anyway, of the trauma that can't be processed, is generally amnesia. Like, the worst traumas are the ones we have no awareness of.
So I'm understanding that there's something going on in your background that you feel or know or kind of can't, you know, shrouded in 94%ness or darkness or shadow,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like it's there, and like, I can't get to this stuff, man. And I want to find, is that the process? Is it like you want to kind of, what is this thing that's going on? Is that the process for you?
Yeah, it's like working on a mystery. It's like being a detective and knowing that there's a dead body somewhere and that the crime has been committed, but you know, having very few clues to go on.
And are you sure this is there? You know, I'm not being crass here, but is this kind of like a mental rivulet that you kind of like you're engaged by, or is this kind of like are you driven by this because there is something that you need to resolve?
Yes, of course. This isn't a mental game.
Okay.
This is an absolute, it's a life and death thing. It has been for years. And
Because you know it's there, or because, something terrible happened that you kind
Well,
of...
no, you know, no is one of those words, right? Because when we're using language, the mind can only doubt, right? There's nothing that can be said that can't be doubted. So if I start to speak, I have to say, I don't know. But if I'm in my body, I know, right? So it's both. It's kind of both. I mean, I know that there's a kind of unprocessed trauma in all of our lives. I know that. And that we live in a world where trauma is being deliberately used to fragment us, to exploit us, to cripple us. I know that. I know that's the world we live in.
You use the word we in that case, and do you think that applies to everybody then? Do you think that applies to me?
Well, I haven't met everybody, so it's a tricky thing. Like I say, you don't necessarily want to get into a more intellectual discussion, but this could do that. But
yeah,
in terms of the culture that we live in, I mean, I can examine the culture and I can see the indications of a traumatized culture that's propagating trauma through the narratives, and that to me is proof. I know them by seeing that. But then individuals, how do I know? I don't know that there aren't somehow exceptions that would seem miraculous to me within this culture. There may well be. I haven't met them, or if I have, maybe very, very few. So most people I meet, I'm aware probably sooner rather than later that they have unprocessed trauma, and that they're not aware
Okay.
of it. Yeah.
So with regards to your wish to engage or release or negate, understand the trauma, I would suggest it, with regards to yoga, you find an Ashtanga class and have a go. And
Oh, I'm in a very small town, so I was very, very lucky to find
okay.
Iyengar. It was just one of
Okay.
those things. And also, and this could be a side issue or it could be a central one, I'm a part of the process, or maybe central to the process of that we're touching on now. For me personally, is very much about surrender, not actually trying to fix anything. And I didn't go to yoga to resolve my trauma. I went to yoga because I'm getting old and I'm not in great shape. So it was a very pragmatic thing.
Yeah.
And so I'm not in any great hurry to resolve this. I mean, I feel like it's resolving itself, and it's
Oh,
and
okay.
even conversations of this kind help. I find that
Okay.
verbalizing what's in the body, what can't be, but what couldn't be verbalized itself, is very healing. So, yeah, it's all very much underway, I think. If we make those steps just to look, to put our attention there, I think there's something so compelling about this 94%, even when it is dark in more ways than, just being unconscious, even when it's actually very unpleasant. It's also compelling because it's what we are, right? It's the lion's share of living that we haven't been having. And so I feel drawn in by the wound in a way that's very enriching, let's say.
Okay, it fascinates you. It absorbs you. It's
It
kind of,
does, yeah. Probably does.
yeah, lovely. And it's this kind of fascination with something is it creates these attractors in our lives that leads us to do what we do, these kind of these fascinators. I mean, women used to wear these things on their heads, didn't they? Little feathers that on little sticks, and they're called fascinators, weren't they? They're kind of, these kind of little feathers and little birds and things. And they're called fascinators, and objects of fascination. It's like, it's like, whoa. For me, it's like choose. I personally, I choose my objects of fascination very carefully. And it's like, okay, what am I absorbing into for this 10 years or this section of life? You're 49, 49. I'm 60, so I'm kind of sort of, And so I can say that 49 to 59, there's this window of 10 years, it's decayed, where you can facilitate or create an opening whereby the object of fascination, or you can have an understand or a glimpse of what the results of the fascination will be. So it's like, okay, is kind of speaking the royal myself, the royal we, but one, it's like, okay, where do I want to be in those 10 years? So if I spend 10 years being fascinated by that, I will become very well acquainted with that. And if I sort of work at this full time over 10 years, I will embody that fully. That will be the nature. You know, I think that there's this kind of throwaway thing that every 7 years our body regenerates. I don't know if it's true or not, but you know, so if you're vegan, let's say, for 7 years, you kind of this, you know, and you're all your body is, you know what I'm saying.
So
there's this kind of, to me, the opportunity exists at this time to choose what the nature of which of that which we wish to engage. Having with examples of people that have followed certain paths, and it's like, okay, I kind of hold that person in great respect. So when I was I think I was in my early 30s, I kind of I've got two kids grown up, one's 30 and 28, my children, and my daughter was a couple of years old, 2 or 3 years old. I was kind of in my early 30s, and I was in the park with her, you know, we're kind of blowing daisy chains or something, you know, I can't remember. And so we sat in this big green kind of, you know, big acre of park or something, and we're just playing, you know, games or something, and completely and there's an old guy sat on a park bench about, you know, quarter of a mile away, just looking at us. And I had this kind of very strange feeling. I saw my daughter, just born, myself, 30, which at the time felt middle-aged, and this guy, old guy, sat on the bench. And I saw, at that point, at 30, I saw my whole... I saw, that's it, birth, middle-aged, death. And I just saw the whole process. It was like, okay, there's the story of life. I was a baby, I'm middle-aged, and I'll be old, and I'll be dead, and it's... Hang on, but that was so quick. And when I was sort of in my early 30s, you know, I was drinking a lot, and well, drinking a fair bit, you know, just kind of pretty selfish, quite reasonably successful money and all this kind of stuff, but pretty kind of low energy, you know, with no aspirations other than making money and getting high and all this kind of stuff. And at 30, it was like, oh, okay. I hadn't realized, it's like, okay, I've got to, there's an opportunity here. So I kind of realized, thought about what I was doing and thought, okay, well, I'm going drinking with these guys. I don't really like them, but we have a great time when we get drunk and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of thought, okay, so what will happen is if I hang around with these guys for the next 30, 40 years, I'll just end up talking about football behind a bar like all these other old blokes do. And you know, nothing wrong in that, but it's like, oh, hang on, this. And so I kind of woke up to this. So I kind of thought, okay, well, who do I really admire? Who in this world do I think I want to be like you? I want some of what you've got. I really like your ways, and you've got a lovely demeanor, and why, you know, and these kind of questions started coming up. And so I kind of chose... I didn't choose. I kind of thought about some people that I respected and admired, and kind of talked to them, or, you know, there was no online back in those days, kind of, you know, found out a bit about people that I respected and thought, okay, I'm going to pick up the threads of what I think their strengths are and start to weave my own life based around these other people's positive experience and lifestyles and kind of contentment. And I kind of gradually built this kind of, over a few years, built this understanding of what sort of person I wanted to be. And then I kind of made some life decisions and decided to follow these paths very, very carefully, and kind of sort of developed, because I knew what sort of old man I wanted to be. And the man you're talking to now is someone that kind of is trained through yogas and meditations and kind of various practices to become the person I wish to be. So it's kind of the opportunity is create for me is creating an attractor of where I want to be, and subsequently the sort of the minutiae, the analyses of, you know, we mentioned it briefly with email, the esoteric and the sort of mystery schools and occult and things. I kind of, it's just like, oh man, you know, you never get to the bottom of that stuff. It's just, it's kind of like, you know, there's always another bifurcation. It's always this, it's all, you know, oh. And, you know, and I kind of journeyed into it, kind of got lost, got frightened, all the normal standard stuff and da-da-da-da-da. And I realized, no, it's actually the mystery schools are, you know, they're endlessly fascinating, endlessly kind of stimulating. But the way it appeared to me, most of these people ended up a little bit, you know, not happy, not contented, not at ease, not peaceful, not, you know, not joyous of spirit. So I kind of chose to let all that stuff go and follow this sort of more spiritual traditions and practices, you know. And this is kind of where I'm up to now, is trying to create this kind of inner environment of a purer, clearer, lighter, you know, these kind of crazy words, experience, that my own journey is about the full realization of that, either probably the way I see my life going at the time of death. So there's this kind of understanding that the time of death, you know, your life goes before you, and, you know, I kind of think I know what that's like. I've had a couple of experiences where I've seen, you know, Jason, where I've seen the birth and death of the universe in a millisecond, and, you know, kind of a deeply psychedelic experience. But this kind of this process where I've seen the universe, the whole process of the universe in the time it takes the universe to live and die in, you know, whatever that means, but in a moment of my visualization in my mind. So it's like, okay, I understand what that's like. So implied within my own construct, and I can only speak from the first person here, is that when I die, this universe dies. So I have an understanding that if you die, my universe carries on, da 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 da. And so, you know, if people around me die, okay, there's a relationship to that. But if or when I die, everything that is the history of the universe, all histories, all families, will disappear. There is no universe other than the one I create.
That's the psyche. I mean, that's one way of understanding the psyche, I think, as our own individual universe. So.
Okay, yeah. And this to me is the along with death, it's very much parallel with death, is this sense that it's possible to potentially recreate or rebirth another universe. So it's like, okay, so if I kind of understand the full gamut of processes, and gradually draw this into the time the moment I die, then the potential is to, okay, reincarnation, perhaps not. I kind of feel that it's kind of, there's something in that, is that, okay, everything's going to go from this universe, and I am going to be responsible for the new universe. So in the meantime, my task to myself, and I'm a bit of a hard taskmaster on myself, mm-hmm. is to sort out the world's problems. And of course, you know, how's that possible? You know, how can I even affect the blackbird that's pulling the worm up outside now? And ostensibly, I can't, but to me, there's this kind of, if it's possible, I believe it is possible to completely purify my mind, my psyche, then my universe necessarily becomes pure now. And it's the the degree of it's kind of like almost putting a lens on the sun, like a magnifying glass, to burn or kind of intensify that, to focus and harness that full power of whatever into my own psyche, your word, to do that. And if I can kind of cleanse and purify, focus that in, I can tip the scales maybe of the sort of the mess or the chaos that appears to be happening in the world now. This perhaps is delusional, but at the same time it serves me and my process well, and I find it there's great succor and comfort in this kind of responsibility of thinking, okay, I've just got to try harder, perhaps try harder is not the correct word, but sort of like, okay, I really want to take this on. And this is kind of why I live the lifestyle I live now, mm-hmm. is because I want to take on more of that. You know, in a way, I'm separate from the world because I'm off grid and kind of don't really, you know, I kind of don't really hang out with people a lot. I do if I wish, but it's like because I want to get deeper and deeper into the process. Hence my work is kind of, art is, you know, I do lots of consultation work. I do lots of sort of processing for individuals. And each person I work with, I draw a mandala, a geometric thing that represents the nature of their trauma from my understand, their trauma, there you go, from my understanding. And hence I'm taught by all my clients, my customers, whatever, about others' traumas, and hence I'm able to empathize, feel, experience that trauma to be able to gain an understanding of what the antidote to it is. Because through, as a result of the meditative training, the retreats and things, I'm able to find, I've got a very fine filing system in my mind whereby I'm able to, if I contemplate, I'm able to find very precise things. Okay, I know exactly what that feels like. I can feel that. You know, if we had a conversation about your trauma, I could find it, feel it, and experience it on an empathetic level. But then I could immerse myself in the trauma, my understanding of your trauma, and then okay, what does that feel like? Feel like in my body mind interface, what's it feel like, and what would I have to do with my mind or psyche in your case to negate that? What is the antidote to that? Oh, I'd feel that, like, so if you one was feeling a particular type of anxiety, I would make myself feel that type of anxiety, and then kind of like, okay, what's the antidote, what's the anti-anxiety neurological chemical that releases that? Because I think the sort of the body functions on this sort of chemical level, so it's a matter of producing a chemical to, you know, because things like anxiety, for instance, anxiety to me is not a mental state. It is not. It's a physical condition.
Sure,
and, yeah. It, you know, and all, these things are physiological. And so they're biochemical, neurological, you know, I'm not able to speak accurately about the sort of semantics here, but it's like, okay, they are feelings, and feelings are not of the mind, feelings are of the body, unless it's and so it's like, okay, so if I'm feeling this, there is a way of delivering an antidote. And and so this maybe relates to yoga on a physical asana sense, but the practices of Vajrayana Mahamudra, the tantric part, so the tantric aspects of spiritual traditions, and I can only speak primarily from a Buddhist perspective, is that the most of the processes that we do are called yogas as well. So it's this kind of, it's like, in fact, this evening, it's every 2 weeks I practice a particular sadhana, a sort of methodology. It's kind of a yoga practice, but it's a mental yoga. And the yoga practice that I'm going to do this evening is actually it's called the Uncommon Yoga of Inconceivability. the uncommon yoga of inconceivability. So, and this is a sort of quite a refined and subtle aspect of the practice of what is called highest yoga tantra. So, this word yoga in this sense. So, there's the 12 drawings I did, the sacred geometry of yoga. The first one was called the tumbled stones of asana. So, tumbled stones of asana. So I kind of did this kind of metaphor, this drawing, whereby I was thinking about how you put lots of rough pebbles in a tumble stone machine. You leave them in there, keep the machine turning for a month or something. They come out polished and smooth and beautiful and all this kind of thing. And to me, the asana actually relates to this. It's like a tumble stone. So you actually go, you know, you start, you click and click and click, you know, the click feeling, click, click, click. And this is kind of, but gradually you do regular practice, the clicks cease and you kind of get this flexibility where you've kind of tumble stoned your thing. But to me, that's only the initial step of yoga. To me, asana is kind of like, okay, to me it was like, okay, that's the first process. So the far, you know, the next level of yoga, as I understand it, is the breath work, the pranayama, which presumably, and that is something that they say is quite advanced, but I don't think it is. I think it's kind of, there's a few red flags about certain aspects of pranayamas, but really they are quite simple, basic things to do. And I would suggest that you know you can have a look, pranayama videos, whatever. There's some pretty good teachers out there. And so, but you know, from there then we start entering the yogas of the mind, and then it's like, then it starts getting really empowering and interesting to me. The physicality is one thing, but to sort of the traumas of the mind, of the psyche perhaps, are sort of, okay, how do I write those things? How do I get this perfect balance that I'm looking for within my mind, which ostensibly is a cessation of duality? You know, it's kind of, that is really, that's the ambivalence, that's the kind of push-pull that to me is the kind of the cause of all the pain.
Look at others, look at friends, I'm trying, grab that feeling that they have, they try. Is it certain, is it known, how knowing, who we lose, who will stay? That you always will be mine. That you always will be mine. That you always will be mine.
Okay. Right, you're going to have to wait until part two of this conversation to hear my response to Mark, and that will be up on Wednesday, the 27th of April, 2016. Stuff is happening, things are moving. Rather than ask for donations this week, I'm asking for those of you who have read and enjoyed Seen and Not Seen, particularly those who downloaded it for free at the website, if you would be so kind as to review the book on Amazon. So far it only has 3 reviews and no mainstream coverage, or no coverage at all, in fact. And that's quite disappointing and frustrating to me, and it still lingers. So please, if you did enjoy the book, do what you can to support it. Write a review, Amazon, however brief, every little bit helps. Those of you who haven't read the book yet, I encourage you to do so. You can see it in the widgets of any page at horticulture.com, a free PDF or a link to Amazon where you can buy the book for a very reasonable price. Not like me to plug my book, but there you have it. I'm going to leave off now. Do check into the second part of my conversation with Mark, because it gets a lot more interesting, and we do go into the very, I was going to say thorny, but I was looking for a more apropos word, the very painful subject of circumcision and ancestral bondage and stuff like that. So be sure and check out part two of the podcast.
I tore a paper off, looking image at the back, drone a prophet on the rock that shrunk my faith, baby. Happy prophets are in luggage up too much, they won't drop dead for the burning for. You wake my favor up for the things deep inside that make life look great, that shrunk my faith, baby. Fallen dreamers are luggage too much when smacking to earth and wondering what they're burning for. That you always will be mine. That you always will be mine. That you always will be mine. That you always will be mine.
That you always will be mine.